Good morning. In a blue state in a red country, is there any room for purple? We'll talk with Hawaii Democratic Party Chair Tim Vandeveer about how Hawaii's congressional delegation works in a national GOP trifecta. And with Thanksgiving approaching, a StoryCorps project's Hope's Family Lore will be captured by younger members. It's time for the Great Thanksgiving Listen. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoop. Marlon Brando's daughter looks back at some of her father's most celebrated movie roles, and Hawaii's faith-based communities come together for the 55th annual Nu'uanu Valley Interfaith Thanksgiving Service.
That's the conversation for this Monday, November 21st, and it starts right after this look at the headlines. Good morning and welcome to a Monday on The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Morning, Beth Ann. I'm thinking back to a recent Monday, November 7th, when a lot of local Democratic Party organizations thought they were sitting pretty.
Well, you know, it isn't over until it's over, and that's what we all found out, didn't we? But, you know, for many Hawaii Democrats, the shock of the election is now being replaced by a key question. How will Hawaii's all-Democratic congressional delegation be able to move its agenda forward? No doubt that's also an ongoing central question behind closed doors with party leadership. And as we just heard in the NPR News, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard met with President-elect Trump this morning for a possible leadership position. We asked Hawaii Democratic Party Chair Tim Vandeveer to join us this morning to see what he considers to be a path forward. And he is in our studio now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning,
Chris.
Thank you for coming in. We've been talking about this, you know, for a little while now. What will it mean for Hawaii? You look at the big map of the United States, and it's very, very red these days. And then there's Hawaii, which is a distinct deep shade of blue. How does our congressional delegation attempt to not only just be able to advance what's important for Hawaii to have on the agenda, but also to just not be, you know, the delegation of no and part of the loyal opposition that always is there to counter?
Well, I think we have to do both. I think our congressional delegation, as the part of the party of opposition now in this administration, has to do two things. One, they have to get out and articulate our values and remind the folks in Washington, D.C., how unique a place like Hawaii is, how we're defined by our diversity and how we embrace diversity and absolutely stand up and not compromise those values. And I think they can also look back historically to many of the firsts that Hawaii had, health care, a woman's right to choose, and remind voters that that works very well, not only in our state, but other blue states around the country. And those are things that we will not go back on, our civil rights progress, things we won't go back on. But I think they can also point to what we're doing here in our state now, currently, to address the problems that we have and find creative solutions, a fundamental role for government, if you will, and point to that and say, yeah, in this laboratory that is our state, as all states are under our system, it works. In some cases, we've got to try and try and try again. But in many cases, it works, and it works for our people. And I think that's the reason why the Democratic Party has been the choice for our voters overwhelmingly for the better part of the last six decades.
Hawaii sometimes is regarded as being sort of an outlier because we are way away from everyone else. And so it may be okay to do something here or to act in a very, diversity responsive way here, but not necessarily something you might see smack dab in the middle of the country.
That's sure. That's one way to look at it. I also think you can look at it as the future of our country, especially the way that our demographics break down. This is the direction that the United States of America is going, whether or not President Trump or anyone in his administration believes that's the way it should be. That's just the way it is. And so I think we can look to Hawaii as the future And it's a future of optimism and hope, not fear and division.
So much of the research that we've seen over the last few years says exactly what you've just said. America's becoming more brown, and we have to be able to understand that, like it or not, this is what's happening, and you're not going to be able to affect that change as much as perhaps some would like or some would think can happen. But as we hear people becoming tone deaf to that, and choosing what they pay attention to and what they don't pay attention to, what do you think is going to have to happen so that that message is really loudly resounding throughout the country that this is not going to be going back?
Well, I mean, I think race and demographics are only part of the conversation. The other part is doing a real, genuine class analysis. What's going on in the lives of working people? And I think by and large on the national level, that's where Democrats fell short. We need to be speaking to the base of our party. We are the party of working people. We are the party of unemployment insurance. We are the party of Social Security, of Medicare, of the things that affect working people and have proven to build our middle class over time, the party of organized labor. So we've got to remind working people that we are there for them, and we've got to prove it out in what we're doing in legislation. So I think that's the other part of this conversation that maybe didn't get, talked to nearly as much as should have been.
And neither was the issues that, or were the many of the issues that were facing millennials and Gen Xers who felt that once Bernie Sanders had departed the contest, that there really wasn't a voice representing them. How do you bring them back into the fold?
As I just said, talking to their interests, talking to the interest of working people. Young people are working people, and I think we have to revitalize the party and remind voters of our proud history and the fact that, we're taking a hard look at our own party, especially the governing body of our party, the DNC, and we're growing the party. There's many around that are still very progressive. As Senator Schott said, calling for a progressive revolution. Many that believe it's time for a new direction. I think that appeals to younger voters. By and large, I think percentage-wise, we saw that appealed to younger voters. So that's the direction we need to head in.
The DNC clearly had a lot of problems this time around. There's also the fact that you have people who are looking at the whole process and don't really want to engage. We saw people sort of dropping out of politics in some ways this last time around. And now this morning we have, Tulsi Gabbard, who was a big supporter of Bernie Sanders, out there meeting with Donald Trump. Clearly too early to make anything of this because, it's conversation. But as you look at it, is this a good step forward to be able to bring more of some of those people into the fold?
Well, I think, the two things. I think, one, it is obviously better to bring more young people into the fold, as I said earlier regarding Hawaii and the way that we look. Compared to the rest of America, we are the future, and absolutely, the younger voters, that's what the future of our country is going to be, people that agree with progressive values, that agree with the way that we approach not only minority populations, but also working people, people that are in the 99%, if you will. As far as Congresswoman Gabbard goes, there is obviously very early to speculate, and there's been a ton of speculation about all the different people that President-elect Trump has been meeting with. I absolutely believe that Congresswoman Gabbard has the interest of the 2nd Congressional District in her heart. I also believe that it's a good thing for Democrats in general to hold positions in administrations. And I believe it's a good thing for us to be meeting. President Obama has met with President-elect Trump. It is the reality right now on the ground. And how that's borne out, I don't know, what the future might hold or what role Congresswoman Gabbard might play. But I think this is an opportunity.
We have to go in just a second. But if you had one wish for how the Hawaii congressional delegation moves forward in this new reality, what's the one thing that's on your list?
Well, they've got to get out there and really stand up for our values. And I absolutely believe they will. We've seen Senator Hirono already get out and call out President-elect Trump for appointing somebody like Steve Bannon to that post. They've got to be vocal. They've got to be out there. I've got every faith and confidence that they will be. They have already. But it's just standing up for the values that make us who we are in Hawaii and doing so with aloha.
Tim Vandeveer, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Tim Vandeveer is the chair of the Democratic Party of Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:13, and coming up, inside Marlon Brando's celebrated method. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a momentous event you might just have missed. On April 23, 2009, then-Governor Linda Lingle signed Home Bill 135 into law, naming for the first time an official state insect for the state of Hawaii. The signing was the culmination of work of a group of fifth graders from Pearl Ridge Elementary School's Gifted and Talented program, who had lobbied legislators to award the honor to one of only two native Hawaiian butterflies. The butterfly can be identified by its bright wings, bold black borders, and 2.5-inch wingspan. It can be found near koa trees, where they feed on the sap that oozes from broken branches. It lays its eggs on the mamaki plant, a native shrub, and when they're young, the caterpillars have an ingenious way of protecting themselves. They make a shelter from the flap of a leaf they wrap around themselves and secure with silk. It takes about 2 weeks for the caterpillar to emerge as this state's recognized butterfly, and that's the name we're looking for today, the Hawaii state insect. If you know, call us at 941-3689. There we go, 941-3689, or you can reach us at 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Few American actors are as widely celebrated as the late Marlon Brando and as little understood. The public often confuse the man with his performances, as happens with so many film actors, and fail to see the tremendous amount of craft that went into every one of them. His daughter, Rebecca Brando, was in Hawaii to attend the Hawaii International Film Festival showing of the film Listen to Me, Marlon. We talked to her about her memories, and she emphasized that her father thought of himself primarily as a craftsman.
He wouldn't consider himself an artist. He'd consider himself a working ant, as he actually put it in songs my mother taught me in his autobiography. The true artists are people like Rembrandt and Rodin and Beethoven. But my dad thought that his acting was a gift that he had, and he was able to do it because he didn't know what else to do in his life but to act. And he loved to mimic and make impressions. Especially if you have a good writer like Tennessee Williams and who give you the words, and if you know how to portray those words and put them in a character, then you've got a great show. You've got a masterpiece.
Several of his films feature excellent writing, and he was a man who understood good writing, wasn't he?
Yes, he did understand good writing because.
He's like a reader.
Yes, he was a reader, and also, like we were just talking, he had rewritten most of the scripts that were offered to him.
Yeah.
And like On the Waterfront, he also rewrote a bit of The Godfather, and most importantly, he actually, on Mutiny and the Bounty, the script was not finished, and he had to refinish it for them. And to the stories that were said about him with Apocalypse Now and Francis Ford Coppola saying that it wasn't easy to work with my dad. Well, you know what? My dad made that script better than it originally was planned, than the original script that was made. He kept it to, you know, it was based on Joseph Conrad's book, A Heart of Darkness.
Yeah.
And he kept it to that. He created Kurtz to be this mystic image, where in having him in portrayed it with shadows and kind of making him an enigmatic figure.
It's very much the way he was in the original short story, that you don't really get to know Kurtz until, you know, you see him in shadow as the story is written.
Right. And that's the thing that my dad and Francis argued about. And the funny story about that, too, is that my dad was in preparing for that role on one of the motus, one of the islets on Techoroa Island. And, you know, one of the islets has no infrastructure. There's no water, electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And so he lived on the motu that looks like there's a lake there, so it's like a swamp, so it's very much like a Vietnam feeling and environment. And he lived there for about, I don't know, 2 weeks, maybe four, preparing for the role. So he really got involved with his roles.
A recent book called Brando's Smile goes in detail into the kind of research that he did for his roles, and it goes completely against the stereotype picture we have of him as somebody who just operated on a kind of blind instinct, that he's often described that way.
Well, the thing is that it's true. Two things there. He did work on instinct, and he was very much a perfectionist. He prepared. He read about the character inside out. He would read about how, if the character was based in, you know, I don't know, let's just say the Wild One, he would read about the population of those kids and the culture. And so he fully prepared to the point where once he was on the set, he'd say, I would forget about all I learned and just act on instinct, because you have the memory from what your research has prepared you for. It just comes out instinctively.
Which is kind of what it needs to do in order to seem real, right?
Yes. I mean, some people can do improvisational things. He did. That's why his improvisation worked so well, for instance, in Last Tango in Paris, where, you know, he studied the character. He was in France. He immersed himself with the French culture and then came on the set, and Bernard Bertolucci had him improvise a moment when he's lying there on the floor, and having him go back to his days and kind of talk about his mom and his father, and that was real. That was very real, and had him crying, a very vulnerable position.
Which you kind of, in order to act and communicate emotion to people, you do have to allow yourself to be vulnerable.
Well, and it's funny because my dad portrayed so many roles where he was a brute, he was kind of savage, the sexy
Stanley
savage
Kowalski,
guy, Stanley Kowalski, Superman,
and
you know, this tough guy in the Wild One, Johnny, and yet there's just such a nice vulnerability to him. He had such empathy and compassion for the underdog, and so he had both, and that's what made him so attractive. Besides him being such a beautiful-looking guy, he was also inside. He had exuded so much vulnerability. And so it all worked. Piecing all that together made him what I think that's what made him a superstar.
You know, his character in The Godfather, for example, does some pretty terrible things, is responsible for some really terrible things, and yet he's a lovable family man.
Exactly.
Who wins the affection of the audience.
Exactly. You know, he said in the beginning when who wanted him? Mario, the writer for The Godfather.
Puzo,
thank you. Excuse me. He wanted my dad to play the role.
Yeah.
And my dad said, no, I could never be a mafioso man. I could never play that role. But he said, no, thank you. And he turned it down. And then Mario again contacted him. He said, really, I think you should take a look at this. And then Francis got on board, and then Francis wanted him. But then the producers at Paramount said, no, let's give him a screen test. So he said, okay, well, let me toy with it. Because my dad didn't want to do something he was unfamiliar with. He didn't want to take a character role that he didn't know that he could take. And that's what he says to actors. Never do something you don't think you can do, and don't do it for the money. Do it if you think you know that you can do it. So he tried it out. He went into the bathroom and stuck some Kleenex in his cheeks and, you know, played around with it, and something clicked. Yeah. Something clicked. And what he liked about it was that behind the mafioso macho charisma that the Godfather has, there was a sensitivity behind it. He was a family man. He cared about those people close to him. So that's what resonated with him. And that's why he was able to portray the Godfather as this genteel person.
For an actor, your job is kind of understanding humanity.
Oh, yeah. I think it explores and excavates so much of your, you know, persona, your emotional background, and really brings to light so many understandings about yourself. You can't understand others until you do understand yourself.
Rebecca Brando is the daughter of the late Marlon Brando, who died in 2004. She was in Hawaii recently to attend the Hawaii International Film Festival showing of the movie Listen to Me, Marlon.
Hawaii Public Radio is grateful for the support of our listeners and for our many community partners, including Gyotaku, Prince Resort Hawaii, and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii. Thank you all for your generosity and participation during our recent on-air campaign.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, completing the 15th year of their Kaipu Aina program, partnering with charities that clean litter from our islands, shores, and parks. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
Many states in the rest of the country have decreased their prison populations by separating who really needs to be behind bars and who doesn't? Low-level, nonviolent offenders. After 4 years with a strategy in place to do the same in Hawaii, what's happened to the Justice Reinvestment Initiative? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
We've talked before about how overstuffed and how troubled our prison system is, that we've got prisons that are falling apart, and that the whole idea was to be able to take those out, extract those who really don't need to be in prison, but who need another form of justice, if you will. What's happened in these 4 years with Justice Reinvestment Initiative?
Well, just briefly, JRI, as we call it, the idea is, as you say, to move from lock them up to rehabilitation, and then take that money that you save and reinvest it in the criminal justice system to ideally help improve our prison system and make sure people get out and are rehabilitated. But it just hasn't turned out anywhere near the promise that we all thought was going to happen. Louis Kinea offers several metrics. I'll give you one in particular that kind of just stands out. The prediction was that once you had JRI in place, you were going to reduce the number of inmates Hawaii has by 900 by this fiscal year. Well, it hasn't happened. It's only 250. And while that's good that we have 250 less prisoners, nothing near what was promised. So this is troubling to lawmakers and advocates of criminal justice reform. Why hasn't Hawaii replicated what has been seen on the mainland?
So why haven't we? Because it seems like there could be, not just it failed, but maybe did we help it to fail?
certainly there was a lot of pressure from prosecutors and law enforcement officials to water down the legislation that JRI produced. I'll just give you a couple of examples. One plan was to be able to post bail 24 hours a day and expand, you know, how you could pay that bail. Well, that didn't make it. There was another initiative to push granting parole under minimal supervision. Well, that didn't pass either. It still takes 32 days for pretrial inmates to be released on bail. Still takes 84 days for supervised release. That is virtually unchanged. So what folks like Kat Brady with the Community Alliance on Prison said is, Hawaii basically has missed a golden opportunity because the legislation, frankly, just has not been strong enough. Bottom line, there's been a reluctance to have true reform here in Hawaii.
Which leaves us where going forward?
Well, one thing that Louis Kanea talked to one person said, one thing that's missing here is a groundswell for change. Even though we're a liberal state, in many ways we're conservative on crime. But if you look at places like California, New York, and New Jersey, really it came from the public pushing for reform. And that would be something that might make a difference because our lawmakers and our leaders would then hopefully pay attention.
I guess some of that may be showing up in the next legislative session. We'll wait and see. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks. Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair joins us every day with a reality check. Lately, articles and media segments have been popping up to help politically split families get through this week's holiday without having the meal turn into a food fight. We're not going to talk about that. Instead, today we're focusing on what StoryCorps hopes families will do, let their younger members capture the oral histories of the important people in their lives. The Great Thanksgiving Listen is open to anyone between the ages of 13 and college. Kate Duff is the program director. She joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Bethann.
Good to talk to you. Now, for a lot of kids, the idea of sitting down and talking to an elder might be a little frightening. You've got a lot of things on the website to help them with that, but what's the entry point that you think that, you know, someone might need to hear to be able to get into or want to get into a conversation with somebody who happens to be an important elder in their lives?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. I think the best way to start with a conversation is to think about your questions in advance. So our students who are doing the Great Thanksgiving Listen, and this is students all over the country who are participating this weekend, are currently at work preparing lots of open-ended questions to start to connect with the elders that they'll be interviewing. So I always recommend that people use a couple of warm-up questions at first. Since this is a project that has teenagers interviewing elders, I think a really great place to start is something like, what were you like as a teenager? Or what was it like when you were in high school? And those are the kinds of things that usually evoke a smile or something that might be a little bit funny that can allow the family to relax a bit, warm up, get started. And from there, then follow a prepared list of questions, but of course also be ready to follow up on something if you hear something unexpected.
You're really talking about being able to establish rapport maybe in a different way than a kid might have with a grandparent or a great aunt or uncle or somebody else important in their family. But for all of these stories, what do you think that they really mean for us as we take these away? Because many people will never hear any of these stories, but they're going to be archived in the Library of Congress, as the StoryCorps segments always are. But what do you think that this means for us as a country to sit down and to listen to each other, particularly right now?
Sure. Well, one of the things that we've learned this year is that we do have some divides in our country, and they can be present in a lot of different places. So if we can practice coming together across a divide in a somewhat more familiar territory with family, with our community, with our neighbors, then we can develop the skills that we need to take that outside of the family or outside of our community. So essentially, the hope is that by practicing this set of skills in a familiar context, you can then take this out and practice this in your life.
The idea of having better social skills and in particular, better listening skills certainly seems to be welcomed by a lot of people, parents, teachers, who have said that a lot of kids simply don't have the attention span to be able to listen attentively and to be able to listen empathically to someone else speaking.
You know, I've heard that, although I've also heard that, you know, our students who do this project take it really seriously, and they will end up learning a lot about themselves and a lot about their families. So I've got a lot of faith in our teenagers and their ability to ask some tough questions, to practice their skills, and then to maybe uncover some interesting family stories.
What about the idea of being able to transfer some of those skills that they're getting through this project to friends who may not be participating in it?
Yeah, well, that's possible, too. So the way that this project works is students record their stories. They use our StoryCorps app. It's free. Anybody can download it. And if they want to share their story, then they can publish it publicly online. It goes to our site at StoryCorps.me, and it's shareable across regular social media by sending a link. Of course, if they'd rather keep it private, that's okay, too, and families can make that decision. But here they have the ability to share it on the Internet and then also, of course, to add it to our National Archive in the Library of Congress, where it's shared not only with folks who are around today, but can be preserved for generations to come and really becomes part of our national fabric and our national history.
I guess what I'm saying, Kate, is sort of, you know, getting underneath some of that a little bit, and as, you know, kids who are teenagers and into college years, too, are also developing ways of coping with the world and being able to talk to each other differently than they do in social media, to be able to have that ability to sit down quietly and listen to someone and to hear the meaning in that person's story and to be able to share some of what he or she has learned with other friends who might need help in developing some of those same kinds of skills. So it's not necessarily just listening to the stories, but it's also about the process.
It's so much about the process. And we know that if you practice the process, you can get better at it. And I think that that's one of the really exciting things about this project, is that by starting with a familiar community, you can then practice those skills a little bit later on in other contexts as well.
Any sense of how many kids will be participating this time?
Well, we had 100,000 participants last year, and we know that our teachers and students who participated in the project enjoyed it, and most are planning to do it again. I'm very excited about how many might be doing it. I think what is also a lot of fun is that this is really a moment for our teenagers across the country and for our families across the country, because in all 50 states, families are sitting down and doing this project together. And I think that that's a really exciting thing to be part of.
Including a lot of families here in Hawaii, we understand that the Department of Education has sent out our link, and so has the Hawaii Association of Independent Schools. A lot of teachers very, very enthused about this project. Thanks so much for spending a little time with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kate Duff is the program director for the Great Thanksgiving Listen at StoryCorps. And again, the Great Thanksgiving Listen information is on our Facebook page, on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. The world is a complicated place. It has trillions of moving parts, and everyone contributes in their own way. But every now and then, someone comes along and does something that pulls all the pieces together. Robert Black was such a person. He was born in Hawaii and went on to become the CEO of one of our largest construction firms. Upon his death, he left $60 million to the Hawaii Community Foundation. This gift essentially made the foundation what it is today. It enabled the creation of thousands of grants, and some of these have changed the face of our state. Beneficiaries of Ben Punahou School, the Hawaii YMCA, Pacific Care, and the E.E. Black Scholarship Fund. Possibly the greatest impact felt across our islands was the funding for the Polynesian Voyaging Society, which, because of the epic voyages of Hokulea, rekindled the Hawaiian Renaissance and all that came with it. This happened because one man chose to give to the future, Robert Black. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, the wet weather is returning, and with it, for a lot of people, congestion, yeah?
You got it. If anybody's ever gotten up out of bed and said, how come I can't breathe through my nose, or why is my mouth so dry? Today we're going to talk about chronic sinus issues, mm-hmm. how to know when it's really serious, and how to know when really some over-the-counter medication might just fix it.
Dry mouth is also a symptom, huh?
Well, it can be if you breathe with your mouth open all night mm-hmm. and you don't realize it's because you can't breathe out of your nose, then you'll often think you have a problem in your mouth, but in fact, the problem is your nose, and
uh-huh.
that's where we should treat you first.
That makes sense. Can it be, are these triggers for perhaps major problems that we don't know about?
It could be. You know, sometimes people have a chronic sinus infection, and despite all their use of decongestants or allergy pills, they don't get better. And there's signs and ways to know if that's the case. So we'll talk some more about that this afternoon and really myth-bust chronic sinus troubles and let people know what's really going on up there.
A lot of the time, it can be an over-the-counter solution, yeah?
It can be. A lot of the medications that used to be prescription are now over-the-counter, nasal sprays, etc. We'll talk more about it today.
Sounds good, Kathy. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Aloha, I'm Jesse Littman from Honolulu. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look at what's happening in our dark island skies, as well as what's happening in the massive universe around our very tiny planet. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips for our report. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's happening?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. This week, stargazers, look out for Venus and Mars in our evening skies. These two planets can be both seen in the southwestern sky after sunset. Now remember, planets are easy to spot because they are very bright, and unlike stars, they tend not to twinkle. Now the moon this week is waning, which is great news for us stargazers because we will be treated to some awesome dark skies by the end of the week.
And we have a return to an astronomy facility on Hawaii Island that we were talking about last week, and now that place has a discovery of a dwarf galaxy, is that right?
Yes, this week a surprising discovery from astronomers atop Mauna Kea using the Subaru Observatory. They have discovered another previously unseen member of the Milky Way's galactic family. It is a faint dwarf galaxy lurking just beyond the outer edges of our own galaxy. It is called Virgo I, as in the letter I. It gets its name from the direction of the sky in which it was discovered, which is, of course, near the constellation of Virgo.
And how many family members does that make now?
Well, before Virgo I was discovered, we had two satellite galaxies. We call them the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds. These are easily visible from the southern hemisphere, but unfortunately, we can't see them from Hawaii.
Unless you're Subaru, right?
Indeed, with its giant eye. Now that Virgo I has been discovered, we can safely say that our intergalactic family is growing.
And how about a little insight into what a satellite galaxy is?
Well, satellite galaxies are small galaxies that orbit bigger ones. Quite often, they can be what we call irregular galaxies due to their irregular shapes. They still contain stars, gas, and dust, just like their bigger cousins such as the Milky Way.
And how do they form?
Well, the Large and Small Magellanic Clouds, for example, are thought to be leftovers from a galactic collision and a galaxy that was swallowed by our own Milky Way billions of years ago. It's possible that Virgo I is also the remains of a galactic collision that happened in that ancient era.
And you're not thinking this is where those aliens in the new movie Arrival came from, are you?
Absolutely not.
It's Christopher Phillips. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for today's programming comes from Chamber Music Hawaii, presenting the Honolulu Brass Quintet performing seasonal selections for brass ensemble, Tuesday, December 6th at UH West Oahu, chambermusichawaii.org.
In today's backyard quiz, the Hawaii State insect was designated in 2009 when a group of fifth graders from Pearl City Elementary asked lawmakers to name one of Hawaii's two native butterflies to the honor. It's a butterfly that lives in Hawaii's forest, feeding on the sap from koa trees. In its chrysalis stage, it employs a clever camouflage that makes it look like a withered leaf. Caterpillars sit motionless on tree branches during the day to avoid being eaten by forest birds and feed only at night. The butterfly emerges after a 2-week gestation and grows into a beautiful butterfly with bright red wings and a 2-inch wingspan. It was first classified in the late 19th century and named for the Royal House of Kamehameha. Its Latin name is Vanessa Tamehameha, but most folks know it as the Pulilehua, or Kamehameha butterfly.
And we had a call from Lihue. Adam Williams knew the answer and will be receiving a prize. It was a very popular quiz. Glad people know that. And I remember during the Gridiron Show, I got to hold the placard for the Kamehameha butterfly.
Oh, excellent.
So, it's special to my heart, too. Anyway, thanks very much for playing the Backyard Quiz with us today. And if you've got a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. It's now 8:48.
Thanksgiving is that rarity among holidays, a celebration that looks beyond religious affiliation without losing its spiritual focus. It's an ideal occasion for an ecumenical interfaith observance, and the Nu'uanu Valley Interfaith Thanksgiving Service is now in its 55th year. Leslie Shimizu is this year's host, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me in today.
It'll probably occur to many of the people attending that this is a particularly good year to be having this event.
I agree with you. I had a different vision, actually, of what it would be like on the night of the event, but I feel even stronger now that it's much more important
Sure.
for us to continue this interfaith event with the community.
Well, obviously, a lot of people thought that things are going to be very different at where we are now, and that's part of what it's all about, is sort of coping with the world that is rather than the world that you might wish it were, yeah?
That's correct.
The
That's
world
correct.
That ain't.
Absolutely. And facing each day as it comes with a joyful spirit and trying to build camaraderie.
One of the things that occurs at services like this is the discovery or perhaps the reaffirmation of common ground among faith-based groups, yeah?
Yes, that's it. We aspire to have all of our guests, attendees, leave with that sense of strong community, joyful connection, that when we go back out into our daily lives, you know, we have a renewed spirit for tackling all those things that come to us every day.
So how do you go about forging that kind of connection?
Well, I think, you know, for us, it starts in the planning. Mm-hmm. You know, we have 10 different organizations. We have different faiths, but we have always been able to come together and try to find the common ground when we're presenting the interfaith event.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this year our theme is Living the Spirit of Aloha. We thought that was very appropriate, you know, because of the sense of the meaning of Aloha and the beauty of the Hawaiian culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are really working to have everybody understand what it means to live with aloha with our fellow community members.
It's a term that's used frequently, and therefore, like many terms that get used frequently,
yes,
aloha tends to lose its meaning, kind of like awesome, right?
That's right. That's right. And so we have a guest speaker that's Demetrio Rice, who will be speaking on kind of a brief interpretation of what it means to live with that spirit of aloha. Mm-hmm. We have a beautiful hula from Harmony Brighter and her hula halau speaking to the Pua Ahihi flower, which is a flower that grows only in Nu'uanu Valley. And she said she picked that theme because that flower, because its growth is dependent upon the intertwining of many vines. Mm-hmm. And it lives at the highest, it grows at the highest peak in Nu'uanu Valley. And she thought that that really represented, you know, all of our community faith organizations working together, intertwining together with the members of our congregations to overcome any kind of barriers that we may have spiritually and to have a united feeling, a sense of purpose.
A lot of the barriers that one encounters spiritually are internal.
Correct. That's right. I think, you know, anytime we're dealing with any situation, we have to look inside first. Yeah. What's our reaction?
Yeah.
Why are we having that reaction? You know, how can we deepen our level of compassion and self-control in dealing with other people? And so that, you know, hopefully we can get that feeling through this interfaith event as well.
And, you know, I want to make a distinction between looking within and self-absorption.
Yeah, that's correct.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Because we've been accused of living, I think accurately, of living in a kind of narcissistic age. It's
yes.
all about me.
Right.
You know, think about me. You go to schools where you're encouraged to celebrate yourself.
Correct.
And compassion calls for you to kind of not suppress, but perhaps look beyond yourself, right?
That's right. And to have an understanding of the situation in front of you or the person in front of you mm-hmm. and how through your own, in the Soka Gakkai, where I'm a member of, we talk about our human revolution. You know, how can you transform your life so that you come from a deeper place of compassion for those in your community?
What if the person, you know, understanding the person in front of you entails adapting to a series of opinions that are very much antithetical to your own?
Yeah, that I think that's definitely a personal struggle. And you may not always get to that point, but you have, I believe we always have to begin again and continue the dialogue and continue the conversation. And even though we don't agree with the other person or what's going on, we have to try to have at least an understanding of where that person is coming from and why they may feel the way they do.
Do you think our society has gotten away from the ability to sort of subordinate the self?
I think so. Yes, I do. And I think that's a real challenge of our faith organizations. And one of the things that we really talked about, you know, like Thanksgiving, when we go to the family dinner table, mm-hmm. you know, obviously, we talk about if politics come up, there's a fight with somebody on and off in the
right.
discussion, you know, but it's real important to lay the groundwork for continued dialogue.
Yeah, because, you know, inevitably, I think when you hear people talking about upcoming Thanksgiving and say, oh, my God, you know, Aunt Ethel is, you know, completely opposite to voted the other way than I did. How are we ever going to get through this? You
right.
know what I mean? And,
correct.
And you hope that everybody gets beyond that. But it does seem as if a lot of divisions have been emphasized in recent year months. Yeah.
Yes, it's true. It's just that we can only change ourselves. You know, we can't change those around us or how they feel. But through, you know, respectful dialogue, we can at least try to have a deeper understanding of each other. And I think when we actually feel that deeper understanding with someone that we may not really agree with, it tends to bring more joy to our lives rather than walking away in a hateful tone or a harmful tone.
We tend to forget that people who disagree with us have their reasons.
That's correct. And at the bottom line of everything, we are all human beings. We are much more similar than we are different in the real scheme of things.
That's a good thought. Mm-hmm. And you know, although it it may seem obvious. It's not obvious in the way people act, right?
That's right, because we look different, we act different, we have different lifestyles, yeah. You know. And one of the biggest, I think, challenges is to remove our own personal judgment of how we believe the world should be.
Hey, let's hope we can carry some of those thoughts forward, Leslie.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much. Leslie Shimizu is a 26-year member of the Soko Gakkai International, SGI, a worldwide organization dedicated to the advancement of peace, culture, and education through dialogue. She's the host of this year's Nu'uanu Valley Thanksgiving service, which is tomorrow evening at the Soko Gakkai International on Pali Highway. And this year's theme is Living the Spirit of Aloha. Bethanel, I think a lot of people might have some sort of vague impression that Thanksgiving is a faith-based holiday, but it's much more broad-based than that. It's not a religious holiday, but it is a kind of spiritual holiday, yeah?
Well, the idea of coming together and being able to have a wonderful dinner and sit down and have conversation, although this year, as we've heard and as we talked about a little bit earlier, of you know what kind of conversation that may be very much directed by how you feel about yourself and how you feel about coming together as a family.
Well, in that case, this year's Thanksgiving is particularly well timed because we've heard so many discussions of divisions in the nation and the things that separate us. Right?
So sitting down and talking about some family stories, being able to upload those to the Great Thanksgiving Listen, all very good, I think, for this year. And being able to moderate yourself a little bit as you're listening to somebody else and really trying to listen to what they have to say, whether you agree with them or not.
Exactly.
It could be a worthy exercise. That's going to do it for us for this Monday morning. Coming up tomorrow. Now, we talked in past months about Hawaii Food Bank's largest distributor losing its warehouse and that it's going to need a new one very soon. Well, that date's coming up pretty quickly. We're going to talk with Feeding Hawaii Together, and we'll get some news from the farm with Neil Conan.
And we'll have a look inside the politics and the economics of the Honolulu Marathon.
You can always reach us at 808-792-8217 to leave us your comments.
Past shows are under talk shows for the conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.